We've been to all four corners of Britain in our quest to interview the great and good of entertainment. Comics, actors, writers, politicians, singers, dancers and choreographers. It doesn't matter who they are. They've all given me their own take on the world they live in and have, in their own way, helped to define what makes Britain great. So join me and my assistants as we get another insight into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
Making his international debut for England against Western Samoa in December 1995, former scrum half Matt Dawson went on to become England's most capped scrum half until recently, winning a total of 77 caps for his country. Dawson went on his first Lions tour in 1997. Fast forward to 2003 and Matt threw one of the most iconic passes in world sport to Johnny Wilkinson, which secured England the Rugby World Cup and thus writing himself into the history of British sport. In 2004, Dawson joined the long-running BBC TV quiz show Question of Sport, featuring as a regular team captain opposite Ali McCoist and subsequently Phil Tufnell. I caught up with the sporting legend to talk tries, broadcasting and his recollections on a fascinating career. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Matt Dawson.
So we'll get on to the major highlights of your career in a moment, but is it true that you had trials for Chelsea playing football?
Yeah, it is. When I was probably 12 or 13, yeah. I was playing at Chelsea Schoolboys quite regularly. But I went to a very rugby-oriented school in Royal Grammar School, High Wycombe.
Yeah.
The Premier League wasn't around. It wasn't like I was going to go and be a 100 grand a week guy. So rugby took over. But yeah, I loved playing football. I would play football on a Saturday and rugby on a Sunday.
So is that why you took the rugby route then, just through school?
I think I was better at rugby than I was at football, and I loved it. I loved playing all sports, like cricket, basketball, everything.
Yeah.
But I suppose because the school was predominantly rugby, it focused me into playing there, and then I would play for Marlow Rugby Club as well, and played for a football team called Flackwell Heath, and then got spotted by some Chelsea scouts and did a bit of midweek training with those guys, played a few games, but workload for school and all the rest of it didn't really allow me to carry on.
So how did you sort of progress into rugby before sort of a senior age? We've got a question about senior rugby in a minute, but how did you sort of move into senior?
I went through all the system really of playing good club rugby, county rugby through my club, and then county through the school, and then you get into the area, the district, region, and then you play in England schools, so you're on that radar. And that was at under 16s, under 18s, and then I played a game for England under 18s at Northampton against France. Northampton asked me to go and have a look, so did Surrey, so did Wasps. I was living in Buckinghamshire in Marlow. It wasn't too far away. And to be honest, when I went to Northampton, I don't really know the reason that it was socially, it was very good. The rugby was good. The same with Wasps and Saracens. I just settled for some reason with Northampton.
Okay, so at club level then, Northampton was the team that you began your senior career with. However, at that time, the sport wasn't professional, was it? It wasn't professional till 95. So tell us a little bit about your life in those sort of early days and how it changed when it went professional in 95.
I did my A-levels and didn't get my grades to university. So it was either I retake or I go up to Northampton, play rugby there, and they've said that they've got a job in a security company as a trainee manager. You know, that was the decision I had. And I think I was impatient and wanting to work. Schooling, I was a bit too young for school. I like sort of working at it now, but at that time I was just very distracted about sport generally and socialising and girls and all the things that teenagers tend to get excited about. So I just saw it as an opportunity to go and you know, move out home, go and live with the boys, get a job, and then be allowed to train Tuesday and Thursday and play at the weekends. I didn't think I was going to be in the first team straight away, but as it pans out because of some injuries and all the rest of it, I ended up getting in the first team in my first year at the club.
Yeah. What was the change then when things did go professional in 95? Was it an obvious moment where you could sort of like stop work and concentrate just on playing rugby? Or
I mean, it was a little bit like that. I mean, I was a trainee manager, and then I went to work in a sales role, a newspaper for advertising, and then I got a job as a teacher. I was working as a PE teacher and geography teacher for a prep school, and I loved it, absolutely loved it. Then 95 came along, and the game went professional. And rather than getting paid, I think I was on £9,000 a year as a teacher, and Northampton were offering me £20,000 a year. So it was a no-brainer. You know, I was doubling my salary, and I was going to be doing something full-time that I absolutely loved. So I was probably a little bit naive and grabbed the pen out of the chairman's hand and signed it straight away without any negotiation, and just got on with it because, you know, to play rugby as a profession was going to be a dream come true, really.
Yes. And you also made your international debut in 1995. Is that right? Against West Samoa?
That's right.
How does that feel when you sort of make your international debut? Were you, I'm assuming you were a little bit nervous?
Yeah. It was at Twickenham. Those sort of hours and weeks and months of training to, you think one day you're going to be good enough to do it, to then all of a sudden running out at Twickenham with Paul Grayson, was my, you know, is my best mate, and a guy we debuted for our country together. So it was incredibly special on that score. But then, yeah, playing at home, having your family and friends there. I don't remember too much about the game because it was all a bit hazy.
Yeah.
Because you're wrapped up in the whole emotion of it all. I probably should do myself a favour and watch it back. But, I remember being in the change room afterwards and it was a bit dreamy, really, as if it didn't really happen, or if it did happen, it happened in a dream. Yeah. But then you sort of get used to that environment, and you focus on, rather than just sort of getting through the experience, you then follow up performances with actually how you should be playing, and understanding the speed of the game, and the distractions distract you less. As more experience you get.
Yeah. And then 1997, that was your first year in the Lions
tour. That was my first Lions tour, yeah.
Yeah. So Joshua said, tours are notorious for their nocturnal events. Mm-hmm. Any crazy nights out? Are there any in particular that...
I mean, there were. I was quite young on that trip, so being in Northampton, we were fairly insular when we were going out to be the same old places. So then all of a sudden being in South Africa and having thousands of people and fans and bars open, it was all a little bit crazy. Durban was always a fantastic night out because they would have the car parks would be full of barbecues or braais, as they would call them. And then actually the stadium at King's Park had a nightclub in it. So you would finish, having a few drinks, then go into the corner of the stadium, and I think it was called TJ's or something like that. And you'd basically have a party still in the stadium. Then you'd go to the beach and have a party in the bit. I mean, you get home just about daylight to get up and train again. You know, I'm not sure they would necessarily be doing that on current Lions tours, but. That was a regular occurrence in 97.
Yeah. Awesome. Would you say, though, that professionally, that was the tour that changed everything for you, a bit of a turning point in your career?
I think it certainly put my name on the rugby map as you know, not just an England or a rookie England player, but someone who could play in a Lions test match. You know, I was second choice on that trip. Rob Howley should have been playing, got injured, and then, you know, it was down to me. I think I then probably got labelled as someone who could play in the big games. You know, it was always very competitive with myself and Kieran Bracken over our England careers, but I think the coaches knew that if it did get down to those, you know, those types of games that needed certain decisions to be made, they could trust me. You know, it didn't necessarily mean that I was going to play, but at least if they were going to pick me, they knew what they were going to get out of me.
Yeah. So I think it's probably about time we moved on to the 2003 situation. What sort of buzz was there around the squad in the lead up to the 2003 World Cup? And what do you think made that team so good? And did at what point did you sort of sense that there was something special there?
I think it was pretty obvious to the squad that that we were absolutely at our peak.
Yeah.
We were not going to get a better opportunity to perform. We'd failed in a few Grand Slams. But then when we went down on to tour before the World Cup, we sort of challenged ourselves to genuinely win those games, to prove not only to ourselves but to the rugby world that we were a genuine contender, and that everybody, it was like a marker being put down, and we hadn't necessarily done that. Certainly hadn't done it in New Zealand. We hadn't done it in Australia for a while. And it gave us a bit of internal confidence, not that we were short of confidence with the players that we had, and we went on winning runs. 21, I think it was, at home that we'd been over a couple of seasons. We were the top team in the world. It was, you know, there was plenty of reasons to be confident, but we just felt we just needed that marker being put down in home territories of New Zealand and Australia. And that gave us a huge amount of confidence. We didn't necessarily play that well in the World Cup. We had moments. With France in the semis, we played really well. But we were good in adversity. You know, we had players that could step up and coaches that would step up and make the right decisions and the big decisions at key moments. And I think that was what was quite unique about that side is it was littered with players who knew how to change the game mid-game rather than waiting for half-time or waiting to the end of the game to review for the next. It was all about the here and now. And if you're going into the World Cups, you know you're going to come up against it. Wales in the quarterfinal, you know, we were getting hammered. We needed to change the way that we played. Clive made a good selection at half-time, and, you know, it sort of sparked up the team a little bit, and we were comfortable winners in the end of that. Same with Australia, with them going ahead early on. There was no panic, and yet we dominated the game. We couldn't get ahead in the game, but we dominated it for a vast majority of the game. But we, you know, we always knew that we had good decision makers headed up by Martin Johnson on the field, which makes life a lot easier.
Yeah. So your pass to Johnny Wilkinson had to become one of them defining moments in British sport. What was going through the mind at that moment?
It was probably one of the hardest making the game, and everything's happening at 100 miles an hour. It's not something you're stopping and think. It's not like you're playing a golf shot and, you know, it's this putt to win the Masters. It's not like that.
No.
Very instinctive. It's very reactive. When you've got someone like Johnny there, you know that if you can put it in the general area, he'll kick it with his right foot or his left foot, it's going to go over. But
yeah.
it was really just getting into our processes from the line out, and then the break that I made through the middle, and the way the rest of the team got us all back into the process, so that I was set to pass the ball to Johnny to drop the goal. You know, we practiced it thousands of times. We've done it in games, in training. And so it was all very much a default for that team to put ourselves in that position. So it felt to everybody else that, you know, this is the moment and, you know, how do you feel? If the truth be told, I don't think anybody would have felt any different than they had if it was in the first minute or if it was in a warm-up game. That was one of the talents that we had as a squad.
Yeah, because obviously that moment, at that point in that game, that was the way that that was going to play out, I suppose. And it was like a decision quickly made that it was going to be looking for that pass and for the drop goal. Is that a decision that ultimately laid with you, or?
When they drew level, it was Johnny and I's decision to work out what the strategy would be for the next minute and a half. That's what nines and tens do. And Johnny, you know, told us, right, we've got to just get us all into the drop goal routine. We have a call for the drop goal routine. Everybody sits in and does their role, whether it's hitting rucks or, you know, keeping hold of the ball for a bit longer, or the line out call was the right call from Ben Kay. So everybody had a role within the call of drop goal routine. Whether it's the pass or it's Neil back going into scrum half, giving it to Martin Johnson because I was at the bottom of a ruck, you know, there were a good sort of 10 or 12 people who had decision-making roles in that last process. It's just, you know, quite rightly, Johnny's kick gets highlighted because it was worth 3 points. But actually, there are lots of other players that had, you know, significant parts to play in that.
Yeah. How do you sort of deal with everything that followed that moment beyond the sort of elation and the celebrations? Was it difficult to jump into all of the media and things like that?
It went to a different stratosphere. Obviously, during the World Cup, it was building up. I suppose the magnifying the celebrity and fame that you get for being part of the World Cup. Exactly the same. It's the person walking down the street that wouldn't ordinarily know who you are, all of a sudden saying, well done, congratulations. Do you then realise that you've done something that's transcended rugby? And that was a little bit, you know, we were all living life like David Beckham for a few weeks.
So after rugby, you chose to go down the entertainment route. What sort of accolade was it to be asked to be a team captain on Equestrian Sport?
Oh, it's amazing. I love it. We've just been on a call now. We're talking about how we're going to film in, you know, social distancing, and we're doing something in August. I love seeing the gang, all the production team, Tuffers and Sue as well. And I mean, it's amazing just to go on the show. I was very excited to go on the show back in, whatever that was, 99 or something, 2000. But yeah, to be asked to be a captain was, I remember the then producer asking me if I would come and do the captaincy for a day for three shows. And I think I was just sort of more starstruck and nervous than I had been playing any kind of rugby. Because I'd grown up watching the show. You know, it was something very special to me and my family. So to be asked to be an integral part of it was very humbling.
And also in 2006, you were runner-up on Strictly Come Dancing. Was it hard being beaten by a cricketer?
To be honest, I should never have been in that final. That was insane. There were quite a few people that were better dancers than me, but good old Equestrian Sport fan base got me through. Yeah. But it certainly wasn't my hips that enabled me to get to the final. It was great fun. Don't get me wrong. Loved it. But there was, I mean, I'm obviously a competitor and I always think that I've got a chance of winning, but that's one moment of my life where I thought, listen, dude, just embrace it. You are not going to win this. So embrace the show. It was good fun.
Skills for life.
Skills for life, yeah.
So you've now become one of Britain's most respected rugby pundits, working for Five Live. Is it difficult to preside over the sport that you love?
No. I find it. I mean, I always sort of promised myself I was never going to. I'm never going to get stuck into players because I've never played with a player who's never not given his all. You know, it's my job to potentially put some colour and reason into why something has happened, but it would never be a, you know, I'm never going to lambast a player unless it was absolutely obvious. And to be honest, I sort of have the mantra I use is, whatever I say, I've got to be confident I could say it to the player if I was having a drink with him face to face. Now, he might not like it, but you know, he would turn around to me and go, yeah, you're right there, Dawes.
Yeah.
And as long as I'm happy that he feels like that and that you're calling, you know, if you are going to absolutely stand on your opinion and go for it, that you truly believe that is the case, then, you know, I'm confident that I've done that. I don't think I've ever commentated and really taken a strong stance on somewhere where someone's pulled me up and said, no, you are categorically wrong. That's not what I was thinking or feeling. If that was the case, then I would probably look at. I mean, you can still call the game and give hard opinion and make it thought provoking, but you know, I'm not the type of commentator who's just going to be controversial for controversy's sake and just for discussion. That's not my style, really.
Do you feel like it's that sort of a big difference between rugby and football, where football seems, especially in the punditry, to be a bit more not like dog eat dog, I suppose, where some of the pundits are shredding the players on a regular basis?
Yeah, I mean, I think the football side of stuff, I think a vast majority of the former players who are calling it have the same view as me. You know, there might be one or two who want to just throw it out there and be a little bit more controversial. Listen, it's their job. For some of them, they get paid the big bucks to be. You know, making those types of calls, whether they're right or wrong, but it's a tricky one. I think there's a moral standpoint when you're doing the commentary. Either you're always going to be a player, or some of those players go into a journalistic view on the spot. And I don't, that's fine. I mean, and some of them have done it fantastically well. But you know, I don't want to be a journalist. I've got lots of other jobs, and I love the game of rugby, and I'll always be a player, not a journalist. So that's why I probably have my slant opposed to any others. And in football, I think football generally is a lot more opinionated. I think it's a lot. It's the nation's game. It's discussed more. I think everybody, even if you're not really into football, you've got a view about football. And so it's a slightly trickier job to commentate on football than it would maybe be on any other sport. Because if the player is a little bit, say, vanilla about the way they call the game, then it doesn't necessarily add to that sort of spice that the crowd generates. Whereas, you know, that I think sort of rugby or cricket, it's just a notch down, I think.
Yeah. So, looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
To go on three Lions tours was amazing. I think there have only been 20-odd players that have ever played in three or more tours out of the 835. So to have been on three of those is, it will always be very, very special. You know, from an England perspective, to play as long as I did and to be part of that team and have those coaches is very tough to beat. You know, and you're quite right that you talk about the Lions a lot. But there have only been 31 players who have had the chance to choose between, you know, what's proudest, going on a Lions tour or winning the World Cup. You know, it's a really tough question to distinguish between. The Lions is from your rugby credentials. I think if you're looking back on your career, you would see that as quite a significant miss in your rugby credentials if you didn't become a Lion and a Test match Lion. Winning the World Cup is probably a little bit scarcer, and spending the time with all of those players and coaches been incredible. 2 or 3 years of our lives.
Okay, so what's next for Matt Dawson?
I'm going to jump in the paddling pool.
Nice.
I work in town. I've got sort of corporate businesses that I crack on with. I've got Five Live. We're doing another series of Question of Sport. Time to spend with the family. And it's an okay space at the moment. I'm not. I don't have any reality shows that I need to throw myself into.
Yeah.
Maybe time just to wind it down a little bit, guys.
Yeah, maybe. No temptation to go and eat some kangaroo anus.
Say that again.
No temptation to go and eat some kangaroo anus or anything like that.
That is probably the one thing that I would have a go at, because it just looks amazing, and everyone that I've met who's been on it have said it's just a fantastic couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But nowadays, I don't think you ask to do those things. You tend to get chosen.
Yeah. Cool.
I think that my two sons would love that. They'd love seeing me struggling in the jungle somewhere.
Yeah. Great. That's they're all questions that Josh has written.
Can't thank you enough for asking me, James, Josh, to speak to you guys.
Thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.